This episode of the Civil Procedure Podcast is an interview with Alexander Ross, Jr. Mr. Ross is a lawyer who represented Robert Nicastro in the famous McIntyre versus Nicastro Supreme Court opinion that put an additional gloss on the Supreme Court's specific jurisdiction jurisprudence. Mr. Ross, who was then a partner at a firm that he founded, represented Nicastro through all three levels of the court system in the state of New Jersey, and then also represented the respondent at the Supreme Court. Mr. Ross is now a partner at the law firm of Weber Gallagher in New Jersey. Mr. Ross is a fantastic interviewee, and I'm confident that you will enjoy this conversation as a compliment to your study of the J. McIntyre Machinery Limited versus Nicastro Supreme Court opinion. Alexander Ross, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. Look forward to discussing the Nicastro case with you. One good place to start is surely the beginning of this case and how you got involved in it now nearly 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, it's an interesting story, Professor, and thank you for inviting me to your podcast. I've had many comments on my case, obviously, and most of them rather incredulous, but nevertheless, it's always a pleasure to talk about it. The interesting fact with the Nicastro case is that it actually came to me as a workers' compensation subrogation action. I represented an insurance carrier, and the insurance carrier paid a substantial amount of money for Mr. Nicastro's workers' compensation benefits. Obviously, as you know from the case, he was working at a scrap metal factory and was walking alongside what's called an alligator shear, which is, as you can picture it, is a device which has a like a big scissor that comes down and cuts metal, and is set on an automatic circulating time where every 15 seconds it comes down. You can set it, you know, manually to work as you're working on it, or if you're in a busy scrap metal yard, it comes down constantly, so they can constantly feed metal into it and cut the scrap metal into smaller pieces. In any event, Mr. Nicastro, this is only about a month after the 9/11 disaster. Anyway, he was walking alongside this machine, and he tripped and fell over some debris that was on the floor. And as he was falling, as we all do, he put his hands out to try to break his fall. And unfortunately for him, his right hand went under the shear as it was coming down to cut metal, and instantly severed the four fingers on his right hand. And obviously, this is a tremendous injury for a working man, especially someone in a scrap metal yard. And he was immediately taken away for surgery and was out of work for a substantial period of time, and has obviously permanent and disabling injuries. And the workers' compensation carrier paid a substantial amount of money for his medical bills and for his lost wages and so forth, and also a large permanency award. And as a result, in New Jersey and in many other states, the workers' compensation carrier has a lien against any potential tortfeasor that might have been responsible for this accident. So clearly, he could not sue his employer because the workers' compensation bar would prohibit him from suing his employer because there was debris on the floor where he fell. So that was out. So what was left was there something wrong with the machine? And so we sent an investigator over to the machine, and lo and behold, the machine did not comply with any of the many guarding requirements that are present in New Jersey and actually throughout the country, whereby a guard should be placed alongside the machine, as you see on many saws, for example, even saws that you use at home, where a plastic or metal guard comes down as you make the cut. For this exact reason, that if you slip, your hand doesn't go under the saw and result in lost fingers. This machine didn't have any guarding at all. And ironically, unlike many other cases, we had our products liability expert, an engineer who, you know, clearly listed a number of violations of safety standards due to the absence of any guarding. And so then we look to see, well, who made this horrible machine that doesn't have any kind of guarding on it? Of course, one thing you have to look at, too, was did the employer somehow remove the guarding, in which case the manufacturer would be off the hook. And we spoke to the employer, and he says, no, I installed the machine exactly as is. I didn't add anything. I didn't take away anything. So that ruled that out, because that's a common defense in these type of cases. And we looked at it, and sure enough, it was made by McIntyre Machines of the United Kingdom and in Nottingham, England, of all places. And then we went on the internet, as everybody else does, and trying to find out something about this machine. And of course, they had a wonderful website, which was part of the appendix to the Supreme Court case eventually, saying how that they are the largest supplier of industrial scrap metal recycling machines and so forth and so on. And they had a website which showed the entire globe with blinking lights showing all the places in the world where they sell their machine, in South America and Asia and India, Africa, and of course, North America, including many states in the United States. And so we found out that at that time, how are we going to serve these people? And we found out that they had a distributor. If you go on their website, they say, if you are in the United States, please contact our distributor. And they have distributors throughout the world. This distributor happened to be in Texas at that time. And so we served the distributor in Texas. And then we also served under the Hague Convention. We sent our paperwork over to Nottingham, England. So this was a very complex process, which is, as you might imagine, rather expensive. You have to hire process servers in England and comply with their rules and so forth. But there is a convention which allows Americans, among other countries, to serve foreign manufacturers. So we got that all accomplished. So the litigation was at hand. The machine itself had been purchased about 7 years earlier by the owner of the scrap metal facility after he attended a convention of scrap metal recyclers in Las Vegas. And the United Kingdom company, the actual United Kingdom company, not the local distributor, was present and had a booth there, as if you've ever been to any of these conventions. And he was extolling the virtues of his machine. And the employer said, this is exactly what I need for my company. It's a wonderful thing. And he bought it as a result of visiting that, then was actually the United Kingdom president was there at that convention and spoke to this fellow. Unfortunately, the owner of the company had a stroke and was unable to give us an affidavit to that effect. But he did say that he was able to provide an affidavit that said that he met with the McIntyre United Kingdom folks in Las Vegas, and that's how he was convinced to buy the machine. At that time, the way the British manufacturer had its distribution set up was that it would simply ship the machine to a Ohio company, which had the same name, called McIntyre America. And that company would then in turn ship the machine to the ultimate user, in this case, the New Jersey company. The irony, of course, is that the McIntyre British company would not ship a machine to the Ohio company unless there was a hard contract for the machine. So it wasn't just a spec job where the Ohio company would have an inventory of a dozen of these machines sitting around in its warehouse and then just ship it out. They would have to say that, okay, we have a buyer in New Jersey or Ohio or wherever, and ship us the machine. And McIntyre UK would ship the machine to Ohio, and then in turn it would be shipped to New Jersey. And unfortunately, the Ohio company went out of business and filed for bankruptcy and liquidation about a year before Mr. Nicastro had his injury. So it was no longer in business, and it was gone, and had no insurance. We checked into that, and it had been totally liquidated. By the time the case came to me, it was about 2 years, almost 2 years after Nicastro's injury, because the statute of limitations in New Jersey for this type of thing is 2 years. And that company was long gone, and there was a new distributor in Texas, which is why we served it in Texas also. Long story short, the only viable entity that was available to sue was the British company. So we filed a lawsuit in Bergen County, New Jersey, which is the county where this injury occurred. And we proceeded along with the litigation, and they answered the complaint, and among their defenses was the jurisdiction defense. And I remember having a number of conversations with the attorney representing the company and him thinking that we'll never prevail on this defense and so forth and so on. But he, as a flyer, he filed a motion for a summary judgment on the issue of personal jurisdiction. And lo and behold, the trial court judge agreed with him. and said, yeah, there's no personal jurisdiction in New Jersey because the McIntyre company, there's no proof that they wanted to sell anything in New Jersey. And of course, we were incredulous, and we filed a motion for reconsideration and asked that there be allowed at least a jurisdictional discovery, which means that you now have to have an entire case within a case in order to determine whether or not there is, in fact, personal jurisdiction over this case in New Jersey. So we had we propounded interrogatories on the British company, and they provided us with a number of emails, not all emails. They said many of them were somehow lost. And of course, there was no way to determine whether that was true or not. But many of the emails they did send were, in our judgment, very incriminating, where they stated, among other things, that they just want to sell their product throughout the United States. We don't really care where, and we want to get paid. And among other things, they specifically indicated that they did not like American law because we have this nasty products liability law where you can actually sue people who manufacture machinery that hurts people. And they didn't like that. So we had a lot of very good emails indicating that they were present at, I think, 15 straight annual conventions of this scrap metal industry. And of course, none of the conventions, unfortunately, were in New Jersey. They were in Las Vegas, Orlando, California, many states. But of course, since New Jersey is not actually a garden spot for this type of thing, they never actually made it to New Jersey. Although ironically, New Jersey, it turns out, has one of the largest scrap metal recycling industries in the country. But nevertheless, we were hoping they would have had a convention in Atlantic City, but regrettably, that was not the case. So they were in Las Vegas. So apparently, according to the Supreme Court, ultimately, I could have sued them in your home state there. But long story short, we went up to the trial judge said, well, I understand, Mr. Ross, they sent a lot of emails around and they were all over the country. But regrettably, they never actually consented or, you know, deliberately tried to target New Jersey. So therefore, there's no personal jurisdiction. So the trial court, what we call the law division in Jersey, dismissed the case. We filed an appeal immediately with the appellate division, and the appellate division agreed with our version of it, saying that indeed there is jurisdiction, and cited a number of cases, both federal and state, which New Jersey has a very liberal long-arm statute, which basically allows jurisdiction almost in every instance, unless it's really obvious that it had nothing to do with New Jersey. So this was, you know, specific jurisdiction as opposed to general jurisdiction. And I'm sure your students know all about that because, you know, as you said, the Nicastro case is now the leading case on this subject, regrettably. But nevertheless, the appellate division agreed with us. And then my adversary appealed it to the New Jersey Supreme Court. And the New Jersey Supreme Court, one of the problems from a practical standpoint was that the New Jersey Supreme Court, which took longer than the U.S. Supreme Court to issue its opinion, the opinion from New Jersey Supreme Court took about 13 or 14 months to come out, as I recall, from when we argued it until when it was decided. Nevertheless, the opinion was so broad and was so, I don't want to say breathtaking, but was so liberal in its description of how the entire world is now a marketplace, that this turned off the Supreme Court. And it was just a bridge too far. And there was one dissenter, I remember him, one of the justices on the New Jersey Supreme Court, who wrote a dissenting opinion, which was about two paragraphs, and basically saying that he hereby invites the U.S. Supreme Court to right this terrible wrong that has occurred here. And as a result, the Supreme Court accepted cert, which, as any lawyer will tell you, of all the thousands of cases that are filed with the U.S. Supreme Court, they take about 83 cases over the course of a year. So, of course, I naturally assumed, well, you know, what are the chances? What are the odds of me getting cert here? This, you know, I'm all set in this case. And sure enough, you could have knocked me over with a feather when I opened my email to find out that, in fact, the U.S. Supreme Court had accepted cert, which was shocking. And it's funny, I've attended seminars with the New Jersey Supreme Court justice who wrote the opinion in my favor, and he too is still to this day dumbfounded and is struck dumb by the fact that his case was reversed, because he really put a lot of effort into his opinion. It was about a 60-page opinion, which was wonderful. And so that's the case in a nutshell.
I'm curious whether in a subrogation action like this, what was the extent of your interaction with Nicastro himself. Did he have a lawyer that was also lurking in the background here, or is this just entirely you from the beginning and you didn't even need to meet him?
It's the latter. It was entirely me. I communicated with him many times via phone. Didn't have a lot of email at that time, as I recall. And he's a working man, and we spoke many times. You know, he answered interrogatories for me and so forth and so on. But because of the way the case came into my office, it was essentially through the insurance carrier, but I represented him as well. Obviously, if we had gotten a positive verdict, he would have recovered the money. The workers' compensation thing would have had to have been repaid back, which is mandatory in New Jersey, at a certain rate. And that's how it worked with that. So that was, at that time, a very steady stream of business for me, was to get subrogation work from insurance carriers. And I would specialize in suing on behalf of products liability or other industrial type accidents.
Can you discuss what roughly the amount of the lien was, just the order of magnitude? Is it $100,000 or?
Well, I think my recollection was that the lien was upwards of over $300,000.
So
he had a lot of surgeries to repair. They, as I recall, they did some reattachment surgeries on his hand, and it was really a devastating injury for this man. And meanwhile, while the case was pending, his wife passed away. So if you look at the caption of the Supreme Court case, you'll see that he is also listed as the administrator of the estate of his wife, Roseanne Nicastro, who had a consortium claim, obviously, for his injuries. So the case took a long time to wind its way from the time of his injury in October of 2001 until this opinion came down in June of 2011. You can imagine it's almost 10 years.
So essentially, if you had recovered $600,000, the $300,000 would have paid off the lien, and $300,000 would have gone to him.
That's essentially right. Roughly two-thirds of the lien gets paid back. There's a deduction for the work that the attorney does, so it's 66% of the lien, typically.
Do you think that the case is any weaker as a subrogation action by an insurer compared to a straight-up personal injury suit by a plaintiff with no fingers sitting at the plaintiff's table?
I don't think so, because Mr. Nicastro, regardless of whether it was me or someone else, if it was some lawyer up in Bergen County who handled Mr. Nicastro's case, he would nevertheless be required to repay the subrogation lien. And the information about that this started out as a subrogation case, you know, was not an issue in the courts whatsoever. The courts didn't care, and that's just something that's just required.
So you didn't seriously consider suing in Nevada, where the sale sort of originated, nor in Ohio or Texas, where the distributor was located?
Well, there was no Texas piece. The fact of the matter is, the distributor, because the Ohio distributor had gone out of business, the McIntyre UK company hired a new distributor in Texas. Mm-hmm. And that just happened to be the distributor at the time when I filed my lawsuit. So the funny thing is, the same argument was brought up by the justice who wrote the dissenting opinion in the New Jersey Supreme Court. He said to me, "Mr. Ross, why didn't you just bring this case in Ohio?" Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, there's no one in Ohio left to sue, Your Honor. The company that was the distributor is gone. The accident didn't happen in Ohio. None of the doctors who treated Mr. Nicastro are from Ohio. They're all from New Jersey. The machine itself is in New Jersey. The expert witnesses will have to visit the machine in New Jersey. There's nothing in Ohio to sue. The first thing that would happen if I sued in Ohio would be the defense would raise forum nonconvenience. There's nothing going on in Ohio. Why are you here?" And they would be right. You know, we're going to drag doctors and Mr. Nicastro and expert witnesses to some court in Ohio for a company that no longer exists. I mean, there's literally nothing to sue in Ohio at that time. So it was frankly preposterous, and it was preposterous to sue in Texas or anywhere else, because there's simply no connection to any other state in the United States except New Jersey.
And ditto Nevada.
Doesn't make any sense, especially since, you know, I was convinced that there was in fact jurisdiction in New Jersey, and I had an appellate court agree with me and the New Jersey Supreme Court agree with me. And, you know, what more proof do you need? You know, it's you had a lot of very intelligent judges who were in my favor, not to mention the dissenting opinion in the Supreme Court, which is I read it again this morning. Frankly, it's devastating against the plurality opinion.
I think your description of the New Jersey Supreme Court opinion is fascinating. You won too well.
I won too well. If they had simply affirmed the decision of the appellate division, almost certainly the case would not have been taken by the Supreme Court, because it would have been just another routine jurisdiction case that had no sex appeal, if you will.
Right.
But when the New Jersey Supreme Court, with a ringing opinion that started out with "the whole world is a marketplace," I believe it starts out to that effect. I encourage your students to read the New Jersey Supreme Court opinion, because it's a wonderful opinion and really describes the way the world works now. Obviously, all of us can go on eBay or many other websites and order something from United Kingdom or, you know, Africa or Asia or China. As we well know, a lot of stuff comes from China. It comes directly to you. I get virus pandemic started, we ordered masks, and the masks arrived with all kinds of Chinese characters on them. And I suppose that if the masks were defective and fell apart, the Chinese company would say, "Well, we didn't intend to sell to New Jersey. You know, what the hell are you talking about? We sold it to a distributor in Indiana. I don't know where the hell he sends it to." One of the arguments I made in my Supreme Court brief was that this theory by the McIntyre company essentially creates a blueprint by which any foreign manufacturer can avoid jurisdiction in the United States simply by hiring an American distributor, which happens to be impecunious or insolvent, and just sell it to him, and then he'll forward it to wherever he wants to. And you could bypass all of the products liability laws and all the safety guidelines that we have developed in the United States over the course of the years. So, for example, if you can imagine, if let's say a Chinese manufacturer of a vehicle decided they didn't want to put airbags in the vehicle because they're too darn expensive, or seatbelts, and they said, "Well, we're going to sell it without seatbelts," and they find some distributor in Oklahoma to sell cars, and they advertise cars without seatbelts. You know, be a tough guy and buy a car without a seatbelt, and sure enough, someone gets into an accident and is severely injured or dies because there's no seatbelt. And the Chinese manufacturer, "Well, we didn't intend to sell it in Indiana, you know, or Ohio or Utah. You know, we just want to sell it throughout the United States, not in any particular state." And according to this opinion, they could get away with that. So it's rather remarkable, especially in this day and age. I'm sure at some point in the not too distant future, this will be reconsidered. But right now, that's the current law.
Well, and your narrative certainly resonates through the dissent with the reference to the pilot-like washing of hands.
Yeah, that's my favorite line in the whole thing, I have to say. Justice Ginsburg, she wrote a magnificent dissent, and you know, she included 12 as an appendix, which is very rare. 12 cases, which specifically are contrary to the majority or plurality opinion. So I've never seen that before, where she actually put an appendix that she created herself of cases that go against what the plurality decided. So, and also, I believe if I read her obituary correctly, there were only about 20 cases where she actually read her dissent from the bench. And this was one of them. And this case came out on the last day of the term. And so obviously this was a subject of great dispute in the Supreme Court, because they literally released it as the last case of that term. So, and the way her dissent is written, you could tell that it was being circulated as perhaps a majority or plurality opinion,
but absolutely
did not carry the day. Right. I basically blame Justice Breyer and Justice Alito for not going along with it. So,
well, weren't they the ones worried about the Appalachian Potters?
Yes, that was. Did you actually listen to the oral argument for this case?
Yes,
that's hysterical. Well, it was either the Appalachian Potters or the Ethiopian Goat Herders.
Yeah, the Ethiopian Goat Herders.
Ethiopian goat. And then the funny part is, after the oral argument, when I was back in my office, my staff got me a stuffed goat, and they taped an Ethiopian flag to it, and that was sitting in my office for years after this opinion, as just a reminder that I neglected to consider the fate of Ethiopian goat herders when I filed my litigation. And as a result, I'm just not a good person. So
that's adorable. A nice reminder.
So my other favorite, just a little anecdote from the oral argument. Justice Scalia asked me how this case would have come out if I had filed it in Bangladesh. And so, as you can imagine, I had studied the in great depth all of the jurisdictional cases, all the way from Penoyer versus Neff to International Shoe to the more, you know, Asahi and so forth and so on. I just did not go into Bangladeshi law in my preparation for this case, nor in my many moot courts that I had in preparation for the oral argument, did any of the moot court professors say, well, Mr. Ross, you better be prepared in case there's a Bangladeshi law question that comes out. And so then I was about to answer that. And then Justice Scalia himself corrected himself, said, no, not Bangladesh, India, because India apparently has a federal state system similar to what we have. And he wanted to know if the case was brought in the city of Madras, in whatever state Madras happens to be in, how would the outcome be? And I still remember to this day, Justice Ginsburg was sitting across the bench and she turned to him and said, and he said, they would allow a lawsuit like that. And she turned to him and said, oh, yes, they already do. They've done this for years. What are you talking about? And they were like an old couple arguing amongst themselves. So it was really rather remarkable. And another anecdote to tell your students about the Supreme Court argument is that you're remarkably close to the justices when you are arguing there. It is, you can literally, if they stuck out their hand towards you and you stuck out your hand to them, you could almost touch fingertips. They're that close. You can just speak in a normal tone of voice. There's no need to be a loud voice. I've had many arguments in front of many appellate courts, and by far the Supreme Court, you're much closer to the justices than in any other appellate court. I've been to the Third Circuit and New Jersey Supreme Court, of course, appellate division. I've never been as close to a justice or an appellate court judge as I was in the Supreme Court. It's really quite breathtaking in that respect.
Thank you for sharing those. Those are fascinating anecdotes indeed. I want to be mindful of your time, but if you would, I'd like to go back one more time to that Texas Supreme Court decision, where I'm absolutely fascinated by the strategic dilemma, the dare I dream possibility of winning too much. Do you have any regrets about how you handled that appeal? Is there something that you could have done or should have done differently?
Yeah, it's funny you should ask that, Professor, but in New Jersey, the Supreme Court gets the same brief that the appellate division gets. You are not allowed to write a new brief for the Supreme Court. That's why when you prepare an appellate division brief, so obviously I appealed the case to the appellate, which is the intermediate appellate court in New Jersey. And when you do that, you have to submit like 20 copies of the brief. And I'm always wondering, why do you have so many? And it turns out because then they forward them to the Supreme Court if there is an appeal to the Supreme. So the reality of the situation is you really have no choice. My adversary petitioned for cert to the New Jersey Supreme Court. I opposed that petition, basically saying that, look, you know, the appellate division case is conclusive and should be upheld and so forth. And I did not ask for an appeal to the New Jersey Supreme Court. My adversary did. And lo and behold, that's the opinion I got. I got this groundbreaking, earth-shattering opinion, basically saying that the whole world is a marketplace, which indeed it is, but apparently only if you consent to being in a specific state, according to the U.S. Supreme Court.
And how frequently did and does the issue of personal jurisdiction surface in your practice?
Interestingly, it's pretty rare. Usually when an answer is filed, one of the affirmative defenses is always personal jurisdiction because you must allege it in your answer to the complaint. You don't have to allege subject matter jurisdiction. Apparently, you can bring that up at any time. If the court has no power or sovereignty over a case, that can be raised even in the middle of trial. You can say, hey, wait a minute, I forgot you have no subject matter jurisdiction. But personal jurisdiction, you can waive. And so routinely, attorneys always raise it as an affirmative defense as part of the boilerplate that you put into your answer to a complaint. But to be perfectly honest, it's quite rare that anybody brings it up, in part because New Jersey has a very liberal long-arm statute. You know, New Jersey is a hotbed of litigation, especially in pharmaceutical cases. There's a lot of litigation in New Jersey in many respects because the pharmaceutical manufacturers are located in New Jersey. Many of them are Johnson & Johnson and Eli Lilly and Merck and many others. And so even if you take a pill in Iowa and you're injured by the pill, the lawsuit will be filed in New Jersey. But that's because the manufacturer is in New Jersey. So obviously there's a jurisdiction here. But where I'm from, the big jurisdictional battles are always in Philadelphia. The county I practice in is adjacent to Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. And the plaintiff's attorneys in Pennsylvania always want to be in Philadelphia County, because Philadelphia County is known for having enormous jury verdict awards. And so you'll have cases which occur in the far distant rural lands of New Jersey, somewhere in the woods, and they will find a way to bring it in the Philadelphia Court of Common Pleas. But it's in the state of New Jersey, an actual litigation over personal jurisdiction is rather rare.
Right. And back on the Nicastro case itself, after the Supreme Court rendered its decision, did the insurer give any serious attention to filing an action in the UK? Was that remotely a possibility, suing McIntyre UK?
Now, ironically, it's funny you should say that, because while the case was pending in the Supreme Court, the company McIntyre UK filed for bankruptcy in Britain. So they were then in bankruptcy and liquidation. And it turns out that they had the insurance policy. They did have products liability insurance, but it was out of a Dutch company. So it was out of Rotterdam, the insurance for them. And the attorneys for the Dutch insurance company has said that because of the bankruptcy, that you'd just be on a schedule of creditors, you'd be unsecured, and you're going to get nothing. There's no assets. Number one. And number two is in Holland, we don't believe in products liability litigation. So I'd have to literally bring the case in. But by then, we're already 10 years after the case started. And who knows what the jurisdictional and statutory limits are for this type of lawsuit over there. So it got to the point where it was just not practical to continue.
I'm curious if there was ever a moment when you had a conversation with Mr. Nicastro where you had to explain to him that someone who may have never left the state of New Jersey, who was injured at a workplace in New Jersey, who received treatment for those injuries in New Jersey by a product that was permanently installed in New Jersey, couldn't sue in New Jersey. I think it's a useful way to check our legal doctrines, to think about explaining them to our clients.
He was rather incredulous by the whole thing, and he was closely following it. He was interviewed. The Wall Street Journal interviewed me at the time, among other local papers in New Jersey. And obviously, like all of us, he was incredulous that such a decision could be had. So, yeah, it was one of those things that happen when you're in litigation. You never know what the outcome is. You think you have a sympathetic case and a good case and a solid case, and there's all kinds of roadblocks that your wily adversaries throw in front of you. And this was one of them.
And is it also your impression, as it is mine, that while some cases hit the big time and some don't, it's impossible to tell which cases are going to hit the big time, and it's only after they've hit the big time that we're going back over each and every little decision that we made as a litigator and wishing that we had spent a little more time on this or developed this point a little bit more. But the big time only comes after those strategic decisions have already been made.
Yeah, very much true. There was nothing really that was outstanding about this case. True, the manufacturer of the machine was in Britain, but frankly, I did not strike me as being such a star-making type of situation. I've had other cases which were much more dramatic, frankly, than this one, in many ways, which are dusty heaps of trash in a landfill somewhere at this point. But nevertheless, this is the one. You just never know when you file a lawsuit. It's one of the things your students should understand, is that you have to be extremely careful. You can't assume that this case that I'm filing today is going to go to the Supreme Court, but you never know. And you have to really prepare and be aware of all the possibilities. So, when you file a complaint, you have to put in as many different counts as you can, allege what you think has to be alleged. And I say leave no stone unturned, but that's really true. You have to be prepared for any eventuality, as we had to be in this case.
Well said. Do you remember studying personal jurisdiction in your civil procedure class?
Yes, I remember studying personal jurisdiction. I remember the professor. And our professor was had previously graduated from that law school. I went to Villanova Law School, and he graduated number one in his class and was a law clerk for a very prominent judge. Ironically, he never contacted me after this case. I frankly don't know if he's still living or not. But
do you have any advice for modern law students?
Well, the main thing I would tell them is that when you take on a case of any kind, you have to look at the case from all different perspectives. A lot of times a case will fall into your lap just shortly before a complaint or a lawsuit has to be filed because of time delays for one reason or another. And as a result, you don't have a whole lot of time, but you have to make all the possible considerations as to what is the likelihood of success, what are the potential problems in this case. Obviously, the fact that the target defendant was in the United Kingdom as a manufacturer was a problem, but we did not think an insurmountable problem under New Jersey law. Under New Jersey law, we were correct. It was under the federal law, which we had a problem. But yeah, that's the kind of thing. The other thing they really should think about is how are you going to finance this litigation? Taking a case through the appellate courts, as you can imagine, this was 10 years of litigation before even one dime was earned on this case. So they have to think about in their own practice, how are we financing this? You know, how is this going to be paid for? I mean, this, you know, obviously it takes an enormous amount of time to prepare these appellate briefs and so forth and to prepare for a Supreme Court argument. So you have to figure out, how are you financing this? Is this something that my firm can handle, or should it be shipped out to a different firm to handle for whatever reason, so that it doesn't overwhelm us in terms of either time or money? So that's a practical piece of advice that I would give to your students.
Last question. I like to ask my guests if they have a book that they would like to recommend, fiction, nonfiction, whether or not related to the law.
Well, I have to say that I have started reading the series of Master and Commander books involving the Napoleonic Wars and naval battles. And for some reason, they just appeal to me. I'm not sure why, but they're very, very interesting. And it's a good way to get your mind off the law, frankly, is to read something that occurred over 200 years ago. And they're extremely well written and very erudite. And I would recommend them to anybody. Other than that, I read a lot of biographies of people. So.
Thank you, Alexander Ross, for your contributions to a profession that I absolutely adore. I enjoyed this conversation very much. You are a perfect guest. And on behalf of myself and all who will enjoy hearing this conversation, thank you for your time.
All right. Well, thank you, Professor. I enjoyed it very much, too. And if there's any further follow-up on it, please don't hesitate to contact me.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. Take care, sir.